Welcome to another episode of Living Downstream. My name is Jane, and I'm the Education and Outreach Leader for Umpqua Watersheds. Before we get started, I wanted to share a little bit about me and my background since I'm new to Umpqua Watersheds. I recently moved to Roseburg from Boston, Massachusetts, where I was working in conservation and trail maintenance. I graduated from St. Michael's College in Vermont with a degree in environmental science, and I'm so excited to be a part of Umpqua Watersheds and to be serving with AmeriCorps. I'm hoping to expand our outreach in the community and bring some new ideas about education to the table. I can't wait to get to know the area and to make a positive impact at Umpqua Watersheds with the help of the rest of our amazing team. Today's episode will focus on waste and recycling in Oregon. We'll hear from Jules Bailey of the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative, as well as from Marla Zoder from Heartwood Resources here in Roseburg. I'd like to continue our previous host Ryan's tradition of starting with a land acknowledgement. It's important to acknowledge the indigenous peoples who lived on and tended to the land before us, including members of the Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquel, and Molalla tribes, as well as others. Our first interview comes from the former education and outreach leader, Ryan.
Our next guest on the show is Jules Bailey, Chief Stewardship Officer with the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative. To start things off, can you share a little about the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative? When was it established and why?
Well, thank you so much, Ryan. It's great to be with you all today. The Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative is kind of the it's the biggest environmental company that nobody's heard of in the state of Oregon. And we are a not-for-profit cooperative owned by beverage industry, and that includes big players within the beverage industry, as well as in many cases, your local craft brewery down the street or small producers. And we're responsible for all aspects of Oregon's bottle deposit return program called the Bottle Bill, lovingly in Oregon. So when you go to the store, you pay your 10 cents when you buy any covered beverage. That's basically any beverage except liquor, wine, and milk. Those are the only things that are excluded from the Bottle Bill. So your kombuchas, your hard seltzers, your beers, your sodas, whatever, that's all in. You pay your 10 cents. And then when you return that container to a bottle drop facility, which we own and operate, or to your grocery store, that container then goes into our system. And we handle every aspect of that, from getting your dime back to you, to processing that material, making sure it's in a state where it can be turned into new materials, in some cases reused, all of the aspects of the system.
How did you get started with this line of work?
Well, I have a sordid past. I started out in politics, of all things. And so, but actually really early on, I was interested in the issues of what we put into the environment and how it affects us down the road. When I was in college, actually, I took a leave of absence from my college and went to Vietnam for a while and worked in hazardous waste management with a nonprofit in Vietnam, working on hospital waste and other things that were being dumped into the river. And then we worked on solid waste. And so it's something I've been passionate about for a long time. You know, we think about what comes into our households and into our bodies, and we don't think a lot about where it goes afterwards, but nothing ever disappears forever. And then I had a couple of U-turns and detours and various paths that happened, and ended up being elected to the Oregon State Legislature, which was a lot of fun. I was chair of the House Energy and Environment Committee. I got to work on a lot of environmental issues, including recycling issues, and including some of the updates to our bottle deposit return system that we're using today. And then I was on the county commission. And when I exited politics, I was looking for what I wanted to do next. And this opportunity came along, and I realized it fit my passions perfectly. It's the opportunity to do good environmental work, do it in a way that's a public-private partnership, and do it in a way that's actually really successful and meaningful for a lot of Oregonians.
Wow, there's a lot there. I have so many questions. I'm trying to think what to ask first. Yeah, so I guess kind of just going back to your experience in Vietnam. So a recent guest we had on the show talked about her experience in Somalia. She served with the Peace Corps before because that's kind of some of the conflicts got started in the 70s, I guess, or 60s and 70s. So, yeah, I guess, like, what did you learn from your experience in Vietnam? I know this wasn't originally what we were going to talk about today, and we'll talk about other bottle stuff in a little bit. But, yeah, what did you learn from that experience?
Well, I learned a lot. One, I mean, just fundamentally learned how big the world is and how important it is to get out and see it. You know, this was in the late 90s, and Vietnam had not been open to the West and to the United States for very long. There was like three Americans working in Vietnam when I was there. We all knew each other. There was a bunch of Europeans, but not many Americans. But fundamentally, what I learned, actually, interestingly enough, was how important it was to work with the community to develop buy-in and support for long-term sustainable solutions. And, you know, it would have been easy for to have kind of this, I don't know, neo-colonialist attitude of, you know, the Westerners parachuting in and telling the locals that they're doing it all wrong and they need to do something better for the environment and creating some system. But not only is that not fair or right, it doesn't work. And so we worked really closely with folks to hear, what are they concerned about? Where do they see the problems in the environment and in waste? What do they want to solve? And how can we help bring some funding to what they want to do? How do they lead in it? And I'll remember very clearly one of the solutions that we came up with. There was a big problem with sharps, with needles. Use needles and the ability to appropriately dispose of them. And one of the problems is that clinics and hospitals didn't have enough money to buy those bright red, beautiful biohazard sharps containers and have them out. They're very expensive and they're hard to maintain. And so we needed a better way to do it because they were literally putting used needles into plastic sacks. And they were poking out the side and creating all kinds of different hazards when people would dispose of them. Not because they thought this was a good way to deal with needles, but they just didn't have a lot of other options. So working with a team, we figured out, well, what's plentiful here and what's not? And it turned out that plastic water bottles were quite plentiful. And so we realized that these were a great way to store needles. And so they would put the needles into the plastic water bottles, seal them off with a cap. And then we had created a disposal unit where you could sort of cut the bottom off the bottle safely. They drop into a kind of a cement tub that was safe. And then you could recycle the rest of the water bottle. And it wasn't a very high-tech solution. It was a very low-tech solution, but it was cheap. It was sustainable. And it was easy for people to say, yeah, that's something that we want to continue doing when this project ends.
Yeah, what a great lesson to learn, you know, working with the community and then thinking about what they need and want. And like you said, that's, you know, total hygienic issue or health hazard. But yeah, using what you have available is such an important lesson. Also kind of two in one. Yeah. It reminds me, we do this Eco Innovations Challenge. We did the first one this year and we're hoping to continue it. We solicited ideas from local community members to see how they would solve local environmental challenges. That's a cool connection that I wasn't expecting to be there. So
that's it. Yeah. And there's also, it was just so cool to see people's pride in their environment and in the solutions they came up with. This is the very early days of microfinance. And so part of the program was we worked with communities to do sanitary facilities in their local communities. And I'll never forget doing an evaluation meeting with some local community leaders to ask them how this was going. And they wanted to do the meeting in the bathroom, in this communal bathroom, because it was the nicest room that they had. And they were so proud of this beautiful bathroom with tile and an actual toilet in it and how clean and sanitary it was. And so we had the meeting in the bathroom and they were very excited to have that.
That's so great. Like really meeting people where they are and with, like you said, what they're proud of. So that's great. Another thing I was wondering about, you mentioned, you know, working in Oregon politics, and I haven't really gone too far into political stuff with this particular show. But I guess just like, yeah, is there anything you'd like to share from that experience?
Oh, so much. We could do a whole show on that. It was a great experience. I loved being in elective office. It gave me a chance to engage on a lot of different issues that I care about, you know, from healthcare and education to the environment, economy and taxes. But it's interesting. I actually hadn't really thought about this until this radio show. But I think what I liked most about it was knocking on doors during the campaign to talk to people. And I knocked on about 10,000 doors myself. And, you know, most people are very busy and they're in the middle of making dinner and they don't have a chance to talk, and that's totally fine. But occasionally you get these folks, and I still remember a lot of the conversations that I had on the doorstep, and you really get a sense of what people care about and what they're interested in. And what it really taught me was there's just a lot more, I mean, it sounds cliche, right? But we just have a lot more in common than we have in difference. And people kind of wanted the same thing. And that was neat. And I always tried to remember that when I was in elective office and things would get really hard and you'd get down in the weeds of stuff and you're negotiating and there's politics of this versus that. And I always tried to remember back to, if I knocked on this person's door and tried to explain to them what's happening in this room right now, would they be on board or would they just roll their eyes and be like, why are you guys doing that? Here's what I want out of this. And here's what I want to have happen. And that was very grounding for me.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. We had another, now that I've gone pretty far in terms of interviewing lots of people, we had another radio show interviewee who was kind of talking about some of what you were talking about too, Yeah, having people work together, think about the commonalities can be so effective in getting progress, you know, because if we are only thinking about the differences, then we can think about those differences and just like hold on to them. And it's, I don't know, it's like kind of like clenching your fist and being like, why can't I like grab onto something new or hold on to something new? It's because we're not open to it, right? So going back to what we were originally going to be talking about today, although I'm really glad we got to share this other information. That's just, thinking about how diverse people are, individual people have so many experiences. So thinking about the bottle drop program and just the bottle collection program, I'm wondering how effective is that? Like, what percentage of bottles are actually returned in Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, and you hit the nail on the head. The ultimate measure of whether or not the program is successful is what we call the redemption rate. So what percent of bottles sold get returned? And there's lots of other ways to measure the program. But at the end of the day, the bottles aren't coming back. It's not an effective program. So Oregon has one of the highest redemption rates in the nation and one of the highest in the world. So in 2019, which was kind of our last normal year, our redemption rate was 90%. So 9 out of 10 bottles sold came back through our system. 2020 was a little bit lower for a number of different reasons. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission, which regulates the bottle bill, closed some of the return to retail options during the pandemic, which made it harder for people to return bottles and cans. So the return rate dropped to 80%, still 8 out of 10 containers sold. But when you look across the nation, you know, Michigan has a very high return rate, 87-88% in Michigan. But their program is much smaller. It only includes basically beer and soda. Ours has all sorts of different things. Water in particular is not in the Michigan program, but it's in ours. And when you look across all those commodities and all those beverage types, 9 out of 10 coming back is pretty successful. And so, you know, what happens after that point is really important as well. It's not just a matter of getting them back, but are you doing something effective with that material? And I think that's been part of the success story as well.
That's great. Yeah, I was not really sure what to expect in terms of the percentage. So that's helpful to know. I don't know if it's your group or like how do people decide what can be returned? Like, is it the content of the plastic or glass or how is that decided?
Yeah, great question. So that's all set by the legislature in Oregon law. And originally it was sort of by beverage type. So if it's beer, it can be returned. If it's soda, it can be returned. If it's in certain packages under certain sizes, we've been moving more and more towards it's the package that's returnable as opposed to what's in the package. Now, as I say, there are still some things that are not in liquor, wine, and milk. We actually have a bill in front of the legislature. We have 2 weeks left in legislative session. What it does is it sets up a process, among other things, for considering adding in wine and spirits into the bottle bill, whether or not that's effective, what the cost would be. You know, the beverage market has changed so much since the bottle bill started. We were the first state in the nation to have a bottle bill in 1971. And at that time, really beer and soda were the only things being sold in packages in the marketplace for the most part that were being littered. And it was really a bill about litter in the first place, not about recycling. But, you know, today we have wine in cans, right? Wine in cans is really popular. And so it's confusing for people to say, well, I have this can of beer and this is returnable, but I have the exact same can, but it has a different label on it and it's wine. Why would this one be redeemable and this one not be? So that's confusing to folks. And I think we need to address that in statute. And hopefully we get a chance to do that. But for the most part, it's defined by the package type. So if it's in glass, metal, or plastic, unless it's liquor, wine, and milk, it's basically in the bottle deposit return system.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's so difficult when things are confusing, because I know that coming here from elsewhere, I've been accumulating a lot of recyclables because I'm thinking like, okay, like back home, this, you know, whatever type of container, not just beverage containers, but other containers too, like this would have been recyclable, but it's not recyclable here. So I guess like kind of thinking of the larger picture too, moving more broadly from beverages, what is and isn't recyclable in general in Oregon?
It's very confusing. I mean, listen, I work in the recycling industry, right? And I go cross-eyed trying to think about what to put in my bin and what not to put in my bin. And there are things that I know aren't supposed to go in my bin that seem like they should be recyclable. And I'm like, I can't throw that away. Called wishful recycling. You know, what I really try to do then is focus on only buying things in packages that I know are going to be recyclable. But that's very hard. I mean, people are busy. I got two young kids, 5 and 2. My wife has a really busy career. And between the two of us being busy and with 2 kids, we don't have a lot of time to think about whether or not the tub of spinach we're buying is in a recyclable container or not. And so the good news is the state of Oregon and the Department of Environmental Quality and others have been doing a lot of thinking about how to make that process more transparent and easier for customers. I only get to focus on the beverage container side of the equation. And in the beverage container side, it's really straightforward. If it's got a deposit on it, you know you can return it and you know it's going to get recycled. And so studies show pretty consistently that in states without bottle deposit return systems, the collection rate for recyclable beverage containers is generally less than 35% and usually less than 30%. Fewer than 3 out of 10 plastic bottles are coming back. That's a real problem. And even those that are coming back are not being turned into the kind of high grade recyclable material that can be used to make new bottles and to really have a closed loop supply chain and economy, because it all gets mixed up together. As you might imagine in your curbside bin, if you have blue bin or whatever on the curbside, you're throwing all that material in there together. It's not easy to sort that stuff all out. Somebody's got to do it. And in addition, stuff gets contaminated and in other stuff. And so the quality of what you get out the back end isn't as good. In a deposit return system, it's being separated right there at the point at which it's being returned. And so what you get back is really high quality material. You know, we can get all the wonkiness within the recycling markets. There's grade A and grade B and grade C and all sorts of different things of material. But suffice to say, only from a deposit return state like Oregon do you get that grade A really good stuff that can go basically right back into making new packaging and new material the same as what you put in there in the first place.
Yeah, that's helpful to know. Like I was thinking also kind of the same time, let's see, how much waste that's going to the landfill could be recyclable elsewhere, or is material that, yeah, maybe if there were, I don't know, either different laws or different ideas about recycling, might not be going to the landfill.
But what I can tell you is we do know that in other countries that have focused on this with policy, they do a better job of diverting things from landfill out of some of that mixed recycling curbside stream. And some of that is just, they're willing to pay more for it and they're willing to invest in those systems. I've seen a system up in Canada, in Vancouver, BC. That is absolutely remarkable. I mean, stuff that down here I just had sort of taken as gospel that was not recyclable was being recycled up there. And I'll never forget going to this plant up in Vancouver. And the input stream is as gnarly as you can imagine. I mean, there was like lawn chairs and mannequins and like weird stuff, just like all in this, and all sorts of different material and coat hangers everywhere and an old TV and all sorts of just crud that's going in. And little by little, this little bit gets sorted out and then this little bit gets sorted out. And then there's robots and machines and people that are doing different things. And you go through a bunch of steps in the process and you get all the way down to the end and you get your two plastics and your three plastics and you get your electronic waste where the old TV's going and you have the trash that's sort of separated out. And they do it, but that's because a lot of the financial incentives are there to spend that kind of time and energy in a way that just doesn't really exist in most places in the United States. And then part of it too is about having end markets for the material. In the US, one of the things that we struggle a lot with is where to send glass. Glass is a very difficult commodity to deal with. It's heavy. It contaminates other things. And once it contaminates stuff, when it breaks, it's very hard to get out because obviously it's not magnetic or anything like that. You can't just pull it out. And then at the end of the day, it's not a very valuable recyclable commodity. So a lot of places struggle with where to send their glass, and a lot of rural communities actually won't take back glass. They make you throw it away. We're able to make glass work because we do get that really clean stream of glass. It's just glass. We're lucky to have a place to send it here in Portland that will take that. But if you don't have the incentives right within the system, it can be very hard to find the right place to send that material, even when you have it.
Yeah, it makes sense then, like you're mentioning how effective Oregon's beverage recycling is. And yeah, if you have a, 5 cent, 10 cent deposit, then, whether the people themselves who have that beverage are going to be like, oh, well, I'll get this money back, or people who really don't have a lot of money and they're going to collect it, then they at least can get some income. So yeah, like having that financial incentive is helpful.
And we know really clearly that every extra 5 cents makes a huge difference, right? So we in 2017, Oregon was at 5 cents a container. And April 1st, 2017, it changed from a nickel to a dime. And the rate of return, the redemption rate overnight went from about 64% to about 85% overnight and then continued to climb. So we know what it is in states that don't have any deposit. About 3 out of 10 containers are coming back. We know what it is in states with about 5 cents deposit, about 6 in 10 containers are coming back. And at 10 cents, 8 or 9 out of 10 containers are coming back. So clearly that money makes a difference. And sometimes it makes a difference to a family that wants it back. And sometimes it makes a difference to somebody who's doing it kind of professionally in a way to sort of meet their basic needs.
Yeah, no, thank you for adding that. Yeah, hopefully, if anybody's listening from out of state, hopefully your state also has a 10 cent deposit. And if not, hopefully they'll head in that direction. Yeah, just going back, I just was thinking back to the glass. So I always thought that glass was, I mean, I understand that like if it breaks, like that makes sense because that could harm someone. But I guess I always thought that glass could just be turned back into glass. Like, is that not the case, or it just depends on if there's dye in it or something?
Yeah, it's a great question. Glass is interesting. Glass is infinitely recyclable. So you can melt it down and make it into new glass as much as you want, which is a great property of glass. The challenge with glass is that it takes a lot of energy to melt that broken glass down. Now, it is better to recycle glass than to make new glass, but it's still very expensive to melt down the old glass. And it's also energy intensive to melt it down. And so your carbon savings are good, but they're not great when you're recycling it. The really powerful thing about glass is that it's easy to reuse. Glass is very durable. It does not take on contaminants in ways that other materials might. You can wash it clean pretty easily and use it again. So we were actually the first state in the nation to bring back a reusable, refillable bottle program. We said, hey, we've got all this glass coming through here. Why are we crushing all of these perfectly good bottles and recycling them when we could be reusing them? So we worked with a glass manufacturer to create a custom bottle for the Oregon market. It's a pretty thick, durable tank of a bottle. And it says refillable, please return, embossed on the container. It's got the markings of Bottle Drop, our company, on it. So people know what they're looking at. It's got sort of a distinct shape. And we created two versions, a 500 milliliter version, which is about 16.9 ounces, and a 12 ounce version. And we basically sell those to local beverage manufacturers. We currently have beer, cider, and wine in those bottles. They put them out into the marketplace with labels that can be washed off. And then we collect the bottles back. We separate them out from the rest of the stream. And then we wash them, sanitize them, get the labels off. And they look like brand new again. And then we get them back to the breweries and the cideries and the wineries, and they refill them and reuse them again. And so depending on how many times that bottle goes through the system, you know, it can have a 95, 96% carbon savings over a one-way package. And so whether that's glass or aluminum or plastic, it is far better to reuse that glass container as many times as possible, because obviously you're not putting any of that energy into the raw materials of that bottle again. You're just putting the energy into the wash and your and the transportation of that bottle.
Yeah, what a great idea. It's neat to know that that exists, because I definitely, I'm more in Southern Oregon, and so I'm not aware of all these different things. And hopefully some of the things going on in Portland will kind of trickle down or, you know, become accessible in other parts of the state.
We actually have most of our participants are actually not in Portland, believe it or not. So we have, we've got Worthy Brewing in Bend, Wild Ride in Redmond, Double Mountain in Hood River, with Bowie in Astoria, Gigantic is in Portland. We have Pierce Wines out of Eugene, Cooper's Hall in Portland. And then we have a couple of other producers. I'm forgetting some off the top of my head, but unfortunately I'm not sure we have any in Southern Oregon right now, or we might, but I got to check on that. But apologies to any Southern Oregon producers who are listening to this that are in our bottles. But yeah, we've really tried to make an effort to make this a statewide program. Now, I want to be clear. It's a really small program of the overall number of bottles. It's still very much in its infancy. And there's challenges like if a bottle leaves the state, there's no way to get it back to reuse it, which really impacts the economics of the program. So right now, it's really limited to breweries and cideries and wineries that have less than 25% of their bottles going out of state. And so that kind of limits it on who can use it. But it's really about proving a concept. And as that starts to work and we show that, yep, these are clean and you can reuse them and they're as good as new glass, we expect more and more people will want to get into them.
People used to reuse glass more, right? I'm like picturing like the milk container, like you put it outside and they like refill it with more milk or something.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, this used to be the norm, right? Like every beverage producer had a refillable bottle. And, you know, it's funny actually. So there was a deposit on those refillable bottles and you'd return them kind of in the crate. And, you know, this was back in the day when you had very large regional breweries. So you had, you know, Henry Weinhardt's in Portland and Olympia up and Rainier in Washington. And they were big enough that people would buy an entire case of the same kind of beer. And, you know, if you were a Henry's person, you were a Henry's person. And if you were a Rainier person, you were a Rainier person or whatever. And And the breweries were also big enough that they had their own wash facilities and they could sort of do it all in-house. Well, with the explosion of craft, that no longer was feasible because breweries weren't big enough to have their own wash lines. People would buy lots of different kinds of brands. It was hard to get it all back. And stores didn't want to take back those whole bottles either. It was really cumbersome for the stores. And so when in the 70s, when this started to phase out, in the 60s and 70s, the slogan for the one-way container was no deposit, no return. So the advertising was, you don't have to pay a deposit on this and you don't have to return it. It was marketed as convenience, right? You just throw them away, no problem. Well, we've now tried, this is really only trivia for old people, but I include myself amongst that. But our tagline for Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative is small deposit, big return. We're turning that on its head. Now, the program comes back and now we have a deposit on one-way containers and it's actually enabled the refillable program to kind of be reborn in this new context.
Yeah, I think sometimes people think about convenience more than the larger impact because, it's like, oh, this is easy for me or it's going to make my life better in some way. But it's important to think about, what happens downstream, as it were. But I just have a couple more questions. So were additional items accepted or recyclable in the past in Oregon? And if so, why did they stop or why did it change?
There's never been anything that's been in the deposit return program that's been taken out. Things have only been added to it.
Cool. Good to know. And then also just thinking about back to kind of our conversation about landfills and what's getting diverted and what's not. Are alternatives to the non-renewable, non-recyclable materials being developed, such as maybe compostable packaging?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And there's a lot of innovation in the packaging space for sure. But it's not always intuitive what the right answer is. So I get very skeptical about compostable packaging. It seems like a good idea, but often it's not. The challenge is let's say you have a compostable a plastic bottle and it looks identical to a non-compostable plastic bottle. Well, that's getting returned through those recycling systems. And when that bottle, which is not made of the same thing that the other bottles are made out of, gets ground up, it gets mixed in with the rest of the recycling system and actually kind of screws up the plastic that comes out the back end and makes it more difficult to recycle that plastic. And so, if I'm imagining a compostable bottle versus a non-compostable bottle sitting out, in a stream somewhere, then obviously, yes, I want the compostable bottle because it will break down over time and the other one won't for, thousands or millions of years or whatever it is. But the first best is to get all of that material back and recycle it or reuse it, in which case those kinds of materials can be actually harmful to that process. And, it's interesting. We've seen because of public pressure that I think is rightly placed on materials, some actually kind of perverse things that have happened. So, sometimes you see, I'll never forget, I won't call them out, but I got on an airline recently, back to flying, I guess, now that I've got my second dose. And I got on an airline recently and they had a sort of a waxed cardboard box with water in it instead of a plastic bottle. That's way worse for the environment than a plastic bottle is. There's metal within that cardboard. It's got that heavy waxing on it. That is not recyclable material. It takes a lot of energy to produce it. Whereas the small plastic bottle is actually very easily recyclable if you get it back and can be turned into new material. But it's hard because there's perception that this plastic bottle is terrible. And this paper box is better. So it gets back to kind of your original question around how do you make this easy for people? So you don't have to have a PhD in materials science to know what's the right answer here. And so one of the things I want to say is as we're putting refund values onto these items, that tells people they can be returned. And two, letting the sort of recycling industry, the beverage industry, figure it out with the right incentives and get the materials where they need to be is tended to work pretty well, because otherwise it can be very confusing what's the best material and what's not.
Yeah, I know that in some areas, I think maybe like by the coast and such, back east at least, they're like trying to develop like compostable, like not necessarily the containers, like the beverage containers themselves, but like the attachments. I don't know what that's called, but like it used to be like plastic rings, and right, like you'd get caught on a sea turtle or somebody tries to eat it or something. And so they're now trying to make that out of something that doesn't necessarily look exactly the same, but it's like edible, like it's made out of like seaweed or something. Cool. So it's like a dried seaweed something. So it ends up somewhere then like is getting eaten, then like it's like food for something.
Totally. And I think that's great. And you know, in my mind, the first best is you get whatever the packaging, whether it's the primary packaging or that kind of secondary packaging or tertiary packaging. First best is you get it back and you recycle or reuse it. The second best is if it's not something that's coming back, then try to make it to something that minimizes the impact on the environment. It sounds like that's what they're trying to do. We obviously don't take back 6-pack rings or that sort of thing. But we do take back, you know, the caps and the labels and things like that. So if you're out there and you're drinking your bottle and you're going to return it, please leave the cap on, because we will recycle that cap along with the rest of the bottle.
Yeah, that's super helpful to know, because I feel like I don't drink alcohol, but like with different types of beverage containers, I always wonder what to do with the cap. Like, so should they leave it on?
Right on. Yep.
Okay.
Screw it back on and return the whole thing, and we'll make sure it all gets recycled.
Awesome. Yeah. So I guess like you've kind of talked about this a little bit, but I guess my last question would just be like, what would your recommendation be for the larger recycling system in terms of like how we could either like reinstate or instate like more recycling, more of a return kind of thing? Would it be to like put that financial incentive on other objects or other ideas?
I think clearly incentives work within the system, and it's going to look different for different types of material. Oregon is now talking about what's the fancy name for it is a extended producer responsibility system, where basically if you're the producer of a material and you're selling it into the marketplace, ultimately you're responsible in some way for making sure that that plastic or that paper or that metal or whatever doesn't end up in the ocean or doesn't end up, you know, in a landfill somewhere. And so the onus is really on that producer to take responsibility for that product all the way through the supply chain. We have that for beverage containers. Our deposit return system is a privately run extended producer responsibility system. It's just one flavor of it, and it's worked really well. And so thinking about how that could apply to other packages, I think is helpful. Now, it gets complicated quick when you get outside of beverage containers. One nice aspect of beverage containers is, for the most part, not always, but for the most part, they're cylindrical, right? So they're pretty easy to handle. They're kind of easy to put in the machines. They're typically one type of material. You know, they have some rigidity to them. So there's some things that within the kind of recycling industry makes them easier to handle. You know, they're not, you know, floppy pieces of material that get tangled in machines made out of 6 different types of material that have to be separated out. So it gets challenging. But the more that you get the incentives right in the system, the more that the packaging starts to look like something that's easier to take care of on the back end, because companies want to be responsible for that. So I think the beverage industry has done a fantastic job in kind of leading the way on this. Doesn't get a lot of credit for it, but has been, I think, doing a good job on it. And the question is, you know, is that model applicable to other industry types?
Yeah, I think it's an important question to ask about, like, yeah, what is the most effective in depending on the materials? Because like you mentioned a couple of minutes ago about how some material, like we have this idea that like, oh, well, paper is better, but it's not always just paper.
Right.
It gets really complicated. So like you mentioned, like some of the beverage containers might be like just, I don't know, aluminum or just glass or something. But yeah, I actually heard recently, like, you know, because I had I have gotten like a chai tea at Dunkin' Donuts, and I've gotten a chai tea at Starbucks. And I'm thinking, oh, the Starbucks one is in like a kind of a cardboardy paper, you know, so it must be better. But I actually heard like if you soak it, there's actually like a plastic liner on the inside. So it's not just paper and you can't recycle it. So yeah, I think I would argue that styrofoam is never good, but yeah, it's more complicated than it would originally seem, you know, like those kind of plastic lined paper containers aren't easily separable. So it just makes
in the non-beverage context too. I mean, I always use this example, but you know, again, I work in the recycling industry. I pay attention to this stuff. I go to the National Resource Recycling Conference. You know, that, let me tell you, that is a fun time. You know, I don't know if you've ever seen those foaming soaps where you push down and you know the foam comes out the bottom and it's in kind of a rigid plastic clear container. Well, we use those at our house sometimes. They like the foaming thing. You know, we're trying to think about, all right, what's the most environmentally responsible way to purchase that product? Well, they sell these bags that are the refill bags for those. And so we think, okay, well, I'm going to get the big refill bag and then I'll just keep the same dispenser and use it again and again and pour from the bag into that soap dispenser. Well, then come to find out, well, that bag is actually made of a bunch of different materials and is probably not recyclable. So is that better or worse than just going out and buying the new container? Because the container itself is actually recyclable of the dispenser, but the spring inside the cap is not. So you have to take the cap part. And it just gets really complicated really quick. And I kind of went, I don't know. I can't figure out which one is better for the environment. We ended up switching to some ceramic dispensers. But I guess the point is, if it's hard for me and my family, it's going to be hard for everybody to figure out exactly what the puts and takes are in it. And so making it simpler for consumers, making producers to some degree responsible for what they're putting out in their environment, and making sure that we have the systems in place that that prioritize good recyclable material is really important. And you know, I think Oregon's deposit return system is an example that works and might work in other venues.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for your time and all of this wonderful knowledge. I feel like you've got given me a lot to think about and hopefully our listeners as well.
My pleasure. Well, hopefully if your listeners are in Oregon, let me put in a plug, go to your local store or your local bottle drop, sign up for our green bag program. It's super easy. You just get a bag. It has your account number on a sticker on the side. You put all your containers in there. You don't have to feed a machine or do anything else. And you just drop it off at any participating store or bottle drop. We'll automatically sort, count your containers and get you the money. There's even an app for that. So we try to make it as convenient as possible to get your refund back. And I hope you'll take advantage of it.
Yeah. And actually, so just a quick question. Do you also do the blue bag program? Because I know Umpqua Watersheds has blue bags. Hey, and we collect them.
You're a customer. That's fantastic. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad you enjoy it. And coming soon, we're even making some additional improvements to that blue bag program. And for your listeners, there are matching periods where we'll match donations given to local blue bag fundraiser nonprofits. We do them around Earth Day. We do them around the holidays. So if you like Umpqua Watersheds, look for that. We'll match some of your donations to Umpqua Watersheds.
Yay. Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it.
More from Living Downstream coming up after these announcements. The Home Explorer series is back in action. This series is designed to supplement or enhance your child's education with science experiments and outdoor-based activities. Check umquawatersheds.org under the Education tab for weekly activities and lessons for your Home Explorer. Those interested in borrowing water quality test kits or microscopes to use at home can contact me via email at jane, that's J-A-N-E, at umquawatersheds.org.
Umpqua Watersheds will be having a volunteer training on Saturday, October 16th, starting at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. During this virtual session, you will learn about current and upcoming opportunities to help with restoration projects, marketing, outreach, and event planning. If you're interested in learning more about how you can get involved with our organization or would like to register for our October 16th training, please email Umpqua Watershed's Director of Education and Outreach at Ryan, R-Y-A-N, at umpquawatersheds.org, and we'll send you the Zoom link along with additional information. We hope you can join us.
Our next interview comes from Marla Zoder, General Manager of Heartwood Resources in Roseburg. All right. So just to get started, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what Heartwood Resources is?
Sure. My name is Marla Zoder, and I am the General Manager. I've been with the company since it was established in 2002, and I've seen the company grow from the early startup days, and I lead the company to where we are today. Heartwood is a 15,660-foot square retail store, and Heartwood has become the go-to recycling store in Douglas County and surrounding counties, such as Josephine County and Coos County. We are a recycling superstore.
Cool. And where is your store located? Just so if people want to come visit, they can check it out.
Sure. We're at 3495 Old Highway 99 South, Roseburg. That's actually in the Green District.
Cool. And would you say that Heartwood Resources has a mission or a mission statement or kind of like a driving philosophy that you follow as a recycling center, superstore?
Yeah. So Heartwood is established, like I said, in 2002 with the triple bottom line: environment, economy, and community. Environment, we prolong the life of the landfill by diverting usable building materials. Economy, we sell used building materials affordable. And community, we employ and provide job training to marginalized populations trying to overcome barriers to employment. That's our mission.
Awesome. And how exactly do you go? So you sell, I guess the first question would be, what kind of things do you sell at Heartwood?
That's why I called it a superstore, because it's a very large variety of donated material. So it could be anywhere from cabinets, tools, lumber, plumbing, electrical, windows, doors, and beyond. It's a large variety of donated material that we handle. And that's why, you know, I refer to it as a superstore. We never know what we're getting in. Every day is different. So it's really exciting.
It's like the giant Goodwill of home building supplies and stuff, remodeling stuff.
Yeah. And then, you know, people love to come here because they can find hard to find items that may be obsolete. And instead of having to buy new, they can come in here and find it. And there's a lot of crafters that love to come here and find just what they need. They're really motivated and, you know, creative people. I'm always amazed to see what they do, what the things that they purchase here.
Yeah, it's probably a great way to end up with a more unique space while also saving stuff from the landfill instead of just getting what everybody else has from like a hardware store, like a Home Depot or something.
Yeah, like I said, they're really creative. It might have been meant for something, but they'll take it and get a complete different use and a complete different life.
Awesome. So how do you go about actually getting all of the salvage materials that you sell?
So we have a pickup crew that does pickups, and then we're open 9 to 5 Monday through Saturday so people can pull up and donate items.
Cool. And what is the most often salvaged material or item that you think you get on like a daily basis or weekly basis?
So yeah, we have local businesses here that really support us, and we're thankful to have them. And just a couple, there's so many to mention, but just a couple I'd like to mention is we get a lot of particle board and MDF from FCC Commercial Furniture. Mm-hmm. And they probably donate on a weekly basis a cargo trailer full of material. And also, we get a lot of preformed countertops from VT Industries. So those are some of the things that we see quite a bit.
Cool. Do you ever find that you have a hard time finding space for all the stuff you get, or do you think that it goes pretty quickly when you get once you get it in the store?
Well, thank goodness we have a large lot, and so some of the material is also you know, outside around the building. Mm-hmm. And we make it work.
All right. And I was looking at your website and I saw, I think there was a number on there, but just so all the listeners can hear and so you can talk about it, about how many pounds of waste do you think that Heartwood Resources diverts from landfills or dumps in the area?
So last year, 2020, we diverted 197 tons that were diverted from the landfill.
Yeah. And I'm assuming a lot of these things are things that, you know, they would end up in landfills, not things that could be recycled, because it's all like building material. So it's stuff that would have gone straight to a landfill and probably would have just sat there for the next couple hundred years or so. That's awesome. Yeah.
So we also, like I said, working with DEQ, and we estimated the carbon dioxide emissions that we were saving. And so we saved 307 metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions were eliminated because of the purchases made of reusable products at Heartwood Resources.
Wow. So mm-hmm. that's something I think that I wouldn't even think about when I'm buying, like if I was remodeling my kitchen and buying like kitchen cabinets, I wouldn't really, you know, there's no tag on the cabinets that says there's 50 tons of CO2 emitted from this cabinet set. So it's interesting to see that and hear that number.
It was interesting to do that. And, you know, it gave us a better perspective. Of what we do.
That's really cool. So I guess obviously you're doing amazing work right now, and there's a lot of impact being made from Heartwood Resources in the moment, but what do you think your vision is for the future? And like, where do you see the company growing or like growing into in the future?
So we were working on extending into Grants Pass. However, that didn't work out, you know, of course, with everything else due to COVID. Mm-hmm. So right now, Heartwood is focused on extending our pickup service area, maybe into Josephine County and Coos County, as well as continuing our efforts in the job training and employing justice-involved individuals, empowering them to be successful.
Yeah. What kind of job trainings do you provide for people at Heartwood? What kind of different roles?
So currently we have Advantage Work Solutions and Sunrise. They bring clients and do job training here at our facility. And currently we are working on bringing on justice-involved individuals to employ them so that they can obtain permanent housing.
Cool. All right. And then I guess, so you mentioned there's like the pickup service. How would people go about finding out more information about a pickup service or just finding out more about Heartwood Resources in general? Are there any places people can go to learn more? Or
sure, you can visit our website at www.heartwoodresources.org, as well as follow us on Facebook.
All right. Well, is there anything else you would like to add about Heartwood Resources or the work you do or any cool stuff going on or cool products you have recently?
So yeah, I just tried a new item. I have a recycled panel insulation and it's the right time of year and it's already doing real well in sales. So, you know, it's just that time of year. So if people are needing to do garages, sheds, we have the insulation. And, you know, I'd just like to say, you know, if you have donations, call the store for a pickup. We'll let them know, you know, what we take and what we don't take and schedule a pickup for them.
What's your pickup radius? How far do you guys usually go for pickups?
You know, we usually quite a ways, actually. You know, we go to Myrtle Creek, Sutherland. And like I said, right now we're working on expanding our service area. So, our hopes are, you know, just to outreach into Grants Pass and Coos Bay. We have customers that come from there. And because we were in the process of moving into Grants Pass, but it didn't happen. So we're just hoping to at least be able to do some pickups in those service areas.
Awesome.
Kind of extend our area.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you.
Yeah. Resources also offers other recycling and redistribution programs, such as egg carton drop-offs and pickups for those with chickens, and paint carton drop-offs for those looking to safely discard of paint. To learn more about the services and products Heartwood Resources provides, visit heartwoodresources.org or stop by the store at 3495 Old Highway 99 South in Roseburg. More about the individuals featured on today's show, please visit the show notes. To learn more about Umpqua Watersheds, please visit umpquawatersheds.org, where you'll find information about the organization, volunteer opportunities, and other ways to support. If you or someone you know would like to be featured on Living Downstream, please email jane@umpquawatersheds.org. Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream. We'll see you in a couple weeks.